A lot of it is AI and machine learning.
Oh, my God.
Maniacs, welcome to a brand new year of the Shop Talk Show, 7th season day. I'm Dave Ripper, with me is Chris Cooley.
Well, how did you know what season? I was going to be like season, I don't know, 12. I can't even remember. Up. You made it up.
It's our 7th year, for sure. I think I did the math there. And we're like, if you do like about 50 episodes a year divided by 300-ish, you get our number here. So 293, I think, is where
We're just starting. Yeah, right. So we're about to hit 300, which would be a full 6 seasons. So yeah, I think you're right. It's about season 7. And our seasons aren't exactly, you know, this isn't the UK over here. We don't do 4 show episode seasons here. These are 50 episode.
Well, and I think around when like Serial was cool, we did like we called a season in the middle of the summer because, you know, doing short seasons was the thing back in 2015.
If you're worried about us talking about seasons and you're being unaware of it on Chop Talk, don't worry. It's absolutely arbitrary. We just really just do shows and number them.
You know, I get a lot of people, they come up, Dave, hey man, how's Shop Talk going? I'm like, it's great. And they're like, yeah, I quit listening. and I'm like, that's okay.
The most honest answer is people that they come in and out of it, which is also completely fine.
I actually super admire that because that's how I do podcasting as well, like listening to podcasts. I just like, I'll hammer out 30 and then I'm like, I can't do another one. So I'm going to take a break. So, anyways,
life just takes me to a place where I'm like commuting more, driving more, road trip, whatever, and they're always there for me. My love for podcasting never goes away, or podcast listening necessarily. Yeah. But sometimes, you get a little burnt out on it.
Yeah. Anyway,
wow, what an intro! What a boring intro. Classic boring podcast intro.
Classic. Hey, welcome to Macintosh Podcast. Whoa. Hey, Chris. Guess what I did this week. I was on an airplane, which means magazine corner.
Nice. What'd you go with? I have a Wired. I kind of fall into that.
Oh, did you get the Wired with the hello? My score is a 3-digit number. No,
I guess I'm one behind then. I get it in the mail,
8th.
Honestly.
Oh, wow. Whoa. Hey, but this is, I haven't actually cracked this yet, but apparently a 3-digit number says everything about you. So I'm very interested in this.
Is it the new INTFJ?
It's the new Myers-Briggs, but it's like an AI assigned something. I don't know. I got some good ones, Chris. I got a little travel magazine because my wife and I are 10 years here, married here, so we're going to try to...
Yeah, you've been camping a lot.
Camping, and you know, I think we haven't really had, like, a vacation in, like, 5-ish years or something, like, where we don't just go to a family member's house. So I think we're going to try to do that this year. So that's kind of for our 10 years. So that's good. So I got a little vacation magazine. But then, Chris, I got two other gems here, okay? I got a Fast Company magazine.
Good one.
With 132 secrets of the most productive people. And when you think of productive people, who do you think of, Chris?
Myself.
All right. Well, you're not on the cover.
Gary
Vee. Guess who is? James Corden. James Corden.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So hey, I thought it'd be cool for the next 132 episodes, we just go through and get some tips from James Corden on how to be productive. Does that sound like a plan?
He's like the Into the Woods and like the,
car karaoke he does, you know?
Oh, yeah. He's even like a talk show host, right? I guess he does a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I guess he could be productive. We could call it productive. But here, all right, the time that James Corden wakes up is between 6 and 6:30. The first thing he does is tell his son to go back to bed. I do the same thing. Mantra, if you're doing it wrong, do it strong. There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, that's James Cord. Actually, has other profiles of other people, so we'll get into that in future episodes. But Chris, I got
doing
one
it
more magazine.
Wrong, do it strong. What's the other magazine?
Yeah, this one is called Survivor's Edge, and it is a magazine for preppers, like doomsday preppers.
Oh, this is your best pick, I think. Real wild card.
Oh
here.
Boy, Terror Report, North Korea cyber attacks, the lone wolf. I was just thumbing through it. Cause again, it was like midnight when I was flying here and I made some impulse purchases, but it teaches you like how to like survive a snowslide, like a avalanche, you know, and like how to set your broken leg. And then there's this whole section that's about finding like setting up caches of weapons and bullets and first aid and burying it and remembering where it is.
Really? Yes. Trying to find like where you buried a bunch of bullets?
Yeah, yeah.
Because you can't count on, because the surface of the earth is obviously destroyed and whatever happens to destroy it. What is they recommend? Yes. Did you read it or are you going to report back?
People have been caching resources like dried meats, fruits, vegetables, tools, medical supplies, and weapons for years. Caching resources is a ritualistic practice during the American Revolution and Civil War. Whoa, that's loaded. Jump back further in time. Paleo Indians and North Americans would cache a variety of stone tools. Oh boy. And then yeah, it's like here, hide a bunch of knives in some logs in a log pile.
Not bad, I guess, but that rots away. Do you like pound a stake in the ground or do you assume that geocaching satellites still exist so you can like
no, satellites don't exist. Satellites don't exist in the doomsday.
So is it like take 8 steps from the cave and then turn right and 12 more steps?
You have paper maps and I think you like build like a little PVC kind of pipe, you know, like a little container.
Ooh,
PVC,
I like that.
Like a clean out.
It's not going to deteriorate.
That should be, pretty weatherproof, you know. And then you put some first aids in there. You put some goo, you know, that like goo you can eat, you know.
Goo. Sure.
Some BC headache powder, some ice pack, adhesive tape, all the stuff you use in the video games to make you better. You need all that, dude. So this is excellent.
I like how it's referred to as caching resources.
Yeah, which kind of ties back to the web and service workers. So yeah, I think
it's kind of a service worker. That's what you could call those things.
Yeah, just little service workers that you hide out in the jungle or the woods near your cabin. That here's how to make a pipe.
Vibe of it pretty like casual? I mean, they sold it at an airport, right? So it's probably not insanely conspiracy theory driven, or was it pretty heavy?
Feeling pretty heavy, man.
Really?
It's like filled with assault rifles. Not that assault rifles are inherently bad, but it's pretty like the world is gonna end vibe here. So we'll follow up, maybe get a subscription, see how the end of the world is going. So
good pick.
I think this was I saw it and I just was like, I gotta have it, and it might have been $10. Whoops. So hey, there you go. Thank you, dear listeners. I guess that's all we got today, Chris. So thanks.
I see you have another story to tell about Android or something, but maybe you gave up on that. I don't even know. I know you're long since Windows and are happy with that choice, which is cool computer-wise, but still we're kind of an iPhone guy phone-wise, weren't you?
Yeah. So iPhone and, my family's iPhone, iMessage, you know, I had worries about becoming a green texter. You know, we call it. I went Android. I bought a Google Pixel 2 XL, and it is an amazing phone. It comes. It's just a beautiful piece. It looks like a teenage engineering project. I mean, it's just beautiful.
Engineering project.
That's the people who make like really cool keyboards and those like pocket operator toys.
I didn't get the reference. My wife's got one though. Same phone. Loves it.
No, it's just darn beautiful. But I hit enough roadblocks in the first 5 days that I sent it back, Chris.
Roadblocks?
Or just red flags and things I did not like.
Because
like,
it doesn't really tie to your developer life all that much, right? Like, it's not like you're trying to set up Bash on your phone or whatever, right?
No, yeah. I mean, it wasn't like, oh, I can't do Rails.
This is just life stuff.
yeah. Yeah, let me see if I have that. Where's that? Where's that old list I wrote? Because I just started, you know. So okay, the first thing, and let me preface this by saying, if you like Android, this is awesome. This is just not this. I think it's totally a not for me thing, and that's what I want
to
say.
I'm fascinated to hear why, because you use Gmail, you use Google Calendar, you use all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, so the Pixel 2 is awesome. The camera's amazing. PWAs are just wonderful, and I want them everywhere now. Like, I got Day Trip and Global Defense, my, like, two little things, little side projects to, like, trigger the, like, hey, can we install to your home screen? And I did, and it was awesome. And there's, like, still some work I can do there to, like, make that experience better for both of those. So I think I'll you know, it's something I think, like, you need an Android in your, like, wheelhouse so you can experiment with this progressive web app and service worker stuff. But man, there are four things I couldn't do or couldn't like handle, couldn't deal with, I guess that's just me.
Number one,
material design and I call it typographical dystopia, just because all the font sizes across the whole OS are just super different. Like app to app, screen to screen, they use this like Roboto or Noto condensed a lot of places, and then they'll like do it bold, and then it's like it just the type didn't work. But then the colors.
So this design system that's generally lauded as being almost too consistent, you found lacking in consistency.
I found it. I found the implementation to be lacking for me. Let me say this too. Material design is amazing. It solves a lot of Google's problems, which is like, I don't know if you remember 5 years ago, it was like every app looked different and it just was so weird and kind of like, just kind of some apps were really gross looking, you know, like, and now everything kind of looks the same and it's pretty good. But I felt like in the OS, you know, like my big thing was like the when you're in like you have the app header, like the color of the app, you know, when you're in the messages app, it like just changes. Like they assign a random color to like everybody. Like Trent was orange, my wife was purple. You know, my friend.
Oh, I see. To trigger some kind of I don't know if I'm looking at purple. I'm probably talking to like subconsciously. I remember who I'm talking to.
Yeah, I guess. But it was just it felt like I was opening a different app every time, and I just was like, I don't know what's going on. Like, this is just like. Almost, you know, like needlessly cartoony. And that's what I'm trying to get away from is like cartoony vibes in my operating system. Okay, and so okay. I think it just had like too much color. Does that mean? And I couldn't dumb it down. And then number two.
Is there
two
a is 1. B?
Well, this is number two, configuration hell. And this is, you know, people, you know, if you don't like the way Android looks or whatever, people are always like, oh, install a new launcher or do a new thing. And, you know, you can customize every single bit of Android. And that's what's awesome. And it's like, cool. Yeah, cool. Except like, I don't want to do that. Like I configure websites and crap for my day job all the time. I don't want to do that with my phone, you know, like that's like, doesn't bring me any pleasure at all. And so that's like a me thing. I started to go down that path and I just like, I don't want to like, just do that for like customize my phone and then it updates and then all that customization breaks. And then I have to wait for, you know, and I just was like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to redesign my phone's interface like through another app. That was number two. Number three, Daydream disappointments. Daydream is cool.
Is that the name of the operating system?
No, Daydream's the VR aspect of Google. And so like you have a Daydream ready phone. And then I bought the Daydream viewer, the little like Google cardboard, fancy cardboard thing you put your phone in. And I thought it'd be cool because I really like cardboard. I like casual VR. I like web VR. I do a lot of like experiments with that. But when you like pull up a website in Chrome and you hit the little VR goggle button and like it goes into VR on your phone, and then you put the phone in your Daydream, like it flashes the like physical viewer that Google provides. It flashes, and then like you're not in the 3D website. You're just looking at the website in a pane, like floating in space. And I just was like, well, that stinks, because when I do it on the cardboard, it actually works exactly how I want it. I just like go into goggle mode, and then I like am looking at a website, but it didn't work that way.
So the Pixel specifically kind of hurt VR in a way.
Yeah, and or, well, not or just the implementation of Daydream. Like I thought it would be like a step up from like a cardboard VR experience, but it just kind of was like totally different, and I just didn't like it. You know, it was cool. The Daydream things I did were cool, but it wasn't my thing. So I don't like it. So, you know, I compare that to like my Windows VR setup that I got. You know, it's like I pull up my website in VR. I don't have to like flip the phone or anything, but that's sort of different. But like I pull up the website and then like I hit the button and then I'm like in my VR experience that I created on the web. I think that's like way better than this Daydream thing where it's like you put the phone in the thing and now you're just staring at the website in a pane, like floating in space. Like I couldn't like go into the thing. So the last thing was like the cat and mouse privacy. Like I felt like I was just playing a game with my privacy and I just didn't like that. And here's the story, the anecdote I will tell. I went to the park with my kids and my family, go to the park. I walk home and then there's like a notification from Maps. And I'm like, oh geez, well, let me check this out, you know? And I open the apps and it's like, rate that park you just went to. And I was like, basically, because like, no, man, like, don't follow me and my kids to the park, you dumb phone. I don't want that. No one wants that.
No.
So I I'm going to send it back moment. And I disabled one of 41 notifications I can get from Google Maps, which is really cool. But disabling the notification doesn't disable the tracking. And so I figured out how to do that eventually. You go into like location services or whatever. And then you go into Google Maps when you start it or when you log into the phone. It's like, can Maps use your location? And you're like, well, yeah, because you're a map. Like, I'm going to let you use your location. But you don't understand that you just allowed it to do location history, which is a totally different thing, where Google keeps track of your location throughout the day in forever. And you can't delete the history. Like, I found a screen where it shows me a map of where Google tracked me throughout the day. Like a physical map of my whole path throughout the day across Austin. And that was like double nope. And then you go into iOS, and iOS actually has the same setting. Like you have to go into location services or whatever in Google Maps, and then you have to turn off location history if you don't want Google to follow you around and keep a log of all your location throughout the day. And that was just me. I'm not like super tinfoil hatty, Chris, but that was just enough for me. And then even when I shut it down, the thing, I was like driving around. My daughter only naps in the car now. And I was driving around. And then the Google search app is like, hey, you're by this mall. Here's what's inside. And I just was like, dude, no.
So that was following the cat and mouse around moment, is that you finally figured out how to disable for the maps, only to have some other app have almost the same level of kind of creepiness.
Exactly. And I just was like, it felt like the feeling I kind of described, it was like I signed into this phone and all of a sudden I was auto opted into like 400 mailing lists. And I just have to figure out which ones I'm in and who's tracking me and which ones I have to turn off. And I just, you know, that was maybe like and a
for
confirmation.
Even for you who are self-described as not particularly tinfoil hatty, it is bothering you.
Yeah.
Which is probably healthy. I almost wish I had your level of worry about this stuff. I should. And I don't know. Sometimes I'm, because if we're too complacent about it, isn't it the obvious future that more and more and more and more and more of this happens to the point where we just accept it as that's what technology is a thing that watches us and the complacency grows? And or do you think it's going to grow to a boiling point moment where people are like, no?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like, I don't know. I mean, I think privacy has to be like the next big frontier, just because everyone has unfettered access to everything about you right now. You know what I mean? Like you, I guess you totally know. I mean, you got doxxed by that dude a long time ago, you know, it just wasn't fun, you know? And you're just like, you have no recourse, you know, like your privacy is just is sacrificed if you want
to. One of the things I learned from that was that he, you know, it wasn't even that difficult of a thing. Like the fact that my social security number is not particularly hard to find on the internet. I think you still at this point, I don't know if you just can raw Google my name and social security number, but you can find it pretty easily on some dark web-ish type of stuff. And that it's really not that big of a deal because social security numbers for pretty much anybody really aren't that hard to find. I'm not unique necessarily in this. And if you want somebody very specifics, it costs you like $3 kind of thing. Like it's already arrived. Like the fact that information is so easy to get for people is, I mean, being doxxed is still pretty horrible.
No, it's horrible, but I guess it's even like doxing is like the ultimate, like, oh God, this sucks, you know, scenario. But the like why does Google need to know everywhere I've walked throughout the day, you know, or every park I went to with my kids? And, you know, like it's this idea that you sacrifice your privacy, your information, and then the computer's going to help you later. You know, and it's like, I don't think, you know, how is this computer helping me? It's like, hey, Dave, heard you like to go to parks. Here's some awesome parks, you know, 10, you know, parks we think you're going to love. You know, maybe that's what they're trying to do. But
did
more
you see
or less,
the tweet, the other that was like Netflix or something that was like, this is a total paraphrase thing, but it was like, to the 17 people who have watched like Hulk Hogan Christmas repeat 35 times, who hurt you kind of thing, which was, I totally get it. It has the right vibe of just kind of a funny, has the right language right now. I could see how somebody typing that up thought, oh, this is going to be a killer tweet. It's totally funny. Yeah. And it kind of, I'm sure some people read it and thought that way. Oh, this is kind of funny. But it also had the right vibe of like, so the social media people at Netflix have access to some kind of query machine internally at Netflix that exposes what customers are watching and how much and how many of them there are and that kind of thing.
Well, which, and 100%, if they can narrow it down to a list of 17 people, you're one click away from getting that user's, you know, name, credit card, like everything about
probably.
Them.
Probably. That's what it implied anyway. Right. I'm sure that... The question was, what is it real? Did they just make that up because it's kind of funny? Or did they really run some queries like that? And who are they? And how anonymized is it? And it's very easy to think it's probably not anonymized at all. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't know, we work here. So we look stuff up in the database sometimes. Big deal, you know? But you're like, Anyway, it just that felt related to me is that there's a deterioration of privacy and that it may not build to a big culmination of everybody getting super mad about it and locking down. It might just be whittling us all down to some kind of future and that we just assume that Big Brother's just watching all the time. That's just the way it is.
Well, not even Big Brother, but like big social media manager. I mean, that one's a great example. It's like, hey, there's this one guy in Texas who only watches documentaries about butts. And isn't that funny on Slack? And then everyone's like, well, let's go see who it is. You know, like
sure, stopping. Yeah. Oh, here's a drone picture of it. Yeah. Which is kind of like I thought The Circle, that movie, was actually pretty terrible, but it kind of goes along with that too. It's a kind of an extension of all these things to the point where they really are like sending drones out to find people and crap like that. And most of the world's just like, yeah, you get them, go for it. You know, the world just claps along with it. The reason why I thought the movie was so terrible is that there's clearly like another way that you can think about these issues, and it broaches none of them. Like none of these high functioning intelligent people, they don't even discuss the implications of what it might be to have cameras just dotting the earth like sand.
Yeah,
nobody even brings it up. I'm like, come on, how good is it? You know,
yeah,
what is this? Like, why not use some of this as an excuse to debate it at least a little bit? Instead, there's one character in it who's Johnny Off the Grid.
Oh, I got that magazine for that.
Yeah, that's some of that.
Johnny Off the Grid. That should be my new.
Anyway, so you sent the phone back. Phone's gone.
I sent the phone back, and I was like, I got this phone. my iPhone 6 was bad, man. It was like running, like I couldn't scroll, you know, like Twitter would freeze when scrolling and stuff like that. That might be a Twitter problem, but like even websites were just like so bad. And my battery only lasted like 3 hours. It was awful. And I was like, well, I want to get my wife a new phone because she needs one. She was on like the 6 or something. She just was like ready for an upgrade. Her phone too was struggling. And then my phone like only lasted 3 hours. So I just was like, I'm buying new iPhones, like going big, and I'm going to buy new iPhones. So bought an iPhone X. It's a great phone. I mean, it's cool. The notch is not as bad as you think, although it's messed up a couple things, but yeah, it's a good phone. But I think where I'm left is I wish it wasn't just, hey, Android or Apple. I wish there's like a third heat, and maybe that somebody's going to be like, have you tried a Linux phone? It's like, no, I haven't. But, you know, I just wish there's like a third vendor, but, you know, it's never it used to third. Be so it's always close, Coke, you know, like Coke, Pepsi.
Windows kind of gave up, right? And I feel like there used to be a little bit more of a kind of a war between it is kind of, you know, I guess that was what was neat about Android is that it's just an operating system, so anybody can use it. And now it feels less and less that way. It feels like, oh, there's the Pixel, and the Pixel's kind of its own thing. And there's still Android, but it's different.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, maybe there's other like things like, you know, maybe Samsung, their version of Android does things enough different that it's less, I guess, like, scary or less or more appealing to my privacy palette, but I don't know, and that's a lot.
Firefox tried to do it, didn't they? Make like a Firefox OS, and it just wasn't good enough.
Firefox, yeah, it doesn't work. If you're interested in I found this little app browsing for Christmas presents, and I didn't want my wife to see recently browse things on Amazon, was a Firefox Focus. Have you heard of that? It's basically a disposable Firefox tab, like, and you know, it uses Chrome or whatever, but it's just kind of Firefox branded. But Firefox Focus, it's on iOS and Android, but it's just basically like a disposable tab. So it's just cool. I mean, if you want to look up your weird medical conditions and stuff like that. So,
oh, I see. It's like an incognito window, but like a one-off, and then you just close it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's basically just an incognito browser. So,
yeah. It's an incentive thing, you know, like what is out there for a, because you kind of got to give, if you want anybody to actually put your operating system on a phone, it's kind of got to like be free, right? Like company's got to be incentivized to do it. And what would incentivize you to spend like years and years and years and years of development, millions and millions of dollars on some operating system to give away?
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, like what, you know, why?
You got to make the phone too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you want to either make money off the hardware or make money off the software, but
so if that's the case, it's like who's going to save us? It's like either some crazy startup, Elon Musk makes a phone, whatever, or it's Samsung at the moment.
Yeah.
But stuff like that changes. We'll be seeing.
Yeah. Well, and you go, hey, again, sorry, I opened it up with like an Apple guys talking Apple podcast, but here we are again. You know, the reason, you know, that Apple came out and it turned out they were like throttling your CPU based on your battery's performance. Did you read all that kind of?
Yeah. Well, I saw they apologize for it now and are giving away cheap batteries or something, but I didn't follow it super closely.
Which is maybe okay, but it's basically like your battery degrades over time, over uses, over charges. That's not news. But what was news was like Geekbench figured out like, oh, Apple like, Not only does the battery degrade, but Apple will throttle your CPU, basically like thermal throttling, but like
which is what people thought they were doing. That's like the perfect tech story because people assumed that's what they were doing for so long. And then a lot of people like roll their eyes like, no, Apple's not actually slowing down your phone. It just feels like that because the phone is older and you're comparing it to if faster things now, only to have it be discovered that no, they literally are slowing.
Yep, they just cranked down the dial on you. So you had like, so my phone was at like zero CPU cycles. So I was basically forced to upgrade because my own phone only lasted 3 hours. My battery was shot. I guess I could have got a new battery, but it's like, it's always that thing. It's like, well, I can spend like $100 on a new battery or whatever it costs, $200 after service or whatever. And then, or like, just do
there's
the
also
whole,
a, like a errand a cost, which I always, depending on who you are and what your life circumstances are, errands can be just really hard to run. Like, I don't want to run three errands when I could run one, even though the one is going to cost me $300 more. Oh, God, at least it's just one errand. I don't have to go to the friggin' mall three times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or twice, you know, which is common, which is drop it off, pick it up. I don't want to go twice. I want to go once.
Yeah. A guy can only eat so much Pinkberry, you know, while waiting on his phone to get fixed. Without a phone? What? I'd get to die. I have to eat out of Pinkberry without a phone. Ugh. Anyway, but no, I just, anyway, so I ended up just buying a new phone, kind of forced upgrade. I'm not happy about that. That was like kind of my first like time buying an iPhone, I think, where it was just like, ugh, I guess I'll buy an iPhone. Like, that just sucks. I don't like
pretty
that.
Good. I have it. I mean, I just don't switch because.
Well, let me say this. The Apple ecosystem is awesome. I got the Apple headphones too, the AirBuds for Christmas.
I'm in my office right now with Tim and he's got some new ones too and he just loves them.
Dude,
so now he's got a watch too. So he gets a phone call. He taps his watch. Gots that going.
Pops in.
I'd be interested in it, but my ears are messed up. They don't. Earbuds don't go in.
You got square ears.
Whatever they are, don't work.
No, those are cool. Like, and that's I think like I like my that first experience was actually awesome. Very Apple like you like I pulled the earbud out and it was like auto like switched or figured out like I had earbuds next to my phone and then I put it in my ear and it's like already playing kind of basically.
Yeah, it's like not really Bluetooth or maybe it incorporates Bluetooth in some way, but it's some extra fancy super no. That's why I was asking around the other, I don't know, it's probably a month ago now, but I'm like, what else is using that, whatever that technology is, and the new Beats do. So I haven't actually pulled the trigger on them because it's a bunch of $100 and I just don't need to, you know, just, you know, money. Yeah, you got to be careful
diaper,
about stuff
diaper
like that.
Bucks. That's diaper bucks.
Yeah, it is diaper bucks. And, you know, so maybe someday because they actually go over my ear and I'll actually be able to do it.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, what I loved about the Apple ones is I take it out, you know, like your spouse is talking to you and you take it out and it auto pauses. And I just was like, what is this black magic that it pauses when it exits my ear? This is amazing. So
this episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by 1 month. That's 1month.com/shoptalk. They're online coding courses. You know, you can learn things like Python, HTML, SQL, JavaScript, WordPress, the stuff we talk about all the time here on Shop Talk Show. The current estimate is like a fourth, 28%-ish of all websites on the internet, crazy thing to wrap your mind around, are powered by WordPress. Huge economy there. Lots to learn there. Definitely an interesting and worthwhile development path for you. 1 month just launched their WordPress training course. Chris Kastig, the teacher, he gives you an HTML and CSS starter theme to work with, and you'll spend that time converting it into WordPress in the best possible way. Totally fantastic thing. I know how to do that stuff. It serves me very well as a developer. It's a very useful skill that I have. And you can learn it too from 1 month. That's 1month.com/shoptalk. Go to that URL because you get 25% off it, which is pretty cool. So you're working with WordPress. You're working with the loop and navigation menus and comments and widgets and functions and WordPress plugins. And you're doing this all from scratch like real world developers do. You'll edit the themes HTML and CSS and PHP, and you'll get your site live on the web. With Chris, you'll be developing, you know, he's built dozens of sites for huge brands. Bacardi, Black Eyed Peas, New York Green Roofs, General Assembly. He makes big WordPress themes. This is a teacher who knows what he's doing. He's going to teach you how to do WordPress, which is fantastic. So 1 month is $29 a month normally, but you go to 1month.com/shoptalk. You get an extra 25% off and you're all set. So 1month.com/shoptalk. Enjoy, folks. Good stuff. We're halfway through the show now. And, you know, we actually do have a lot of good questions. I don't know if we'll get to any of them, but we're still a question and answer show. We'll have plenty of questions to answer as we go through the year. And please send us in some more if you have them.
And we have a lot of guests and stuff, a big list of people we're going to invite on. We haven't given up on the guest thing. It's just so fun for Chris and I to talk. So.
No. And in fact, I'm really doubled down on this podcast, honestly, or I don't know what percentage down on it, but we went big here. Not only do I have an office now here in Bend, Oregon, which And I got my audio stuff all set up in the office there, and I was pretty happy with how it all sounded and all my equipment. I'm like, yeah, podcasting, getting in the groove. And you know, I'll be coming back into the office with more regularity. You know, my daughter's now 2 months old and going to be 3 months old, and we're going to have a nanny. You know, I'm getting back into the swing of things after the big dadding. And, but you know, I work in a somewhat small space with my friend, Tim, you know, my co-founder of CodePen, the earbuds guy. Anyway.
And you work with the Craft CMS folks too. They're in the,
we have a one big office that we all share, but they have a different like closable door space that they work in. They actually have two of the three of those, and we have one of them. And then there's a conference room and a kitchen that we're building and a big, it's a nice office. So Tim and I are a smaller piece of it, and we work in the same actual room together. So when I have to do this, like imagine me, podcasting, Apple, you know, whatever. Yeah,
Apple.
It's
Apple
a little annoying to him who's trying to do some work. So we're like, you know what we should do? Let's get some, I don't know, get some of that that eggshell stuff, and we'll get some plywood, and we'll just build our own little booth. Prime, not even for audio quality that much, because actually the audio equipment that I have works great in that room already. It sounded good. It's designed and configured to kind of sound like a sound booth, but not have to actually be in a sound booth. And there's actually a ton you can do for sound by just like putting a box around the microphone. Like you don't actually have to be in a sound booth. You can get that sound booth sound in other ways. And anyway, but that doesn't block me being annoying to Tim. And I do a fair amount of podcast. We do the show every single week. I have to record little audio spots for it for ads. We do CodePen Radio as well. And, you know, I record videos sometimes for CSS Tricks. There's a lot of time I'm talking into a microphone. So we're going to do the thing. Buy some eggshell, get some boards and whatever, and just do it ourselves. And then we're like, you know what? Tim just happened to know, or maybe you read an article or something. There's this company called Vocal Booth, literally vocalbooth.com, not a sponsor, although if they'd like to sponsor the show, I'd love to have them as usual.
Yeah, send me a booth.
No, yeah, send some booths. Booth it up. They make these booths. After I just got done saying we don't really need a booth, which is true, we decided to pull the trigger on a pretty fancy vocal booth. So I'm standing in it right now. I hope you probably won't be able to notice too much. But yeah, but I'm not annoying anybody else in the office. I can be as loud as I want because this thing is... First of all, it's out in the space where we just have declared that anybody can be as loud as they want because it's a fun office, god dang it. But also just, you know, I'm just in here by myself. It's ventilated. It's lit. It's got wires in here. I got a ceiling-mounted boom for the microphone. It's like a very fancy podcasting setup here. So I love them. It's a great product, and it's made right here in Bend. That's why he knew about it. We drove down the street to pick this thing up.
Wow. See, that's a shopping local, getting a booth. I've been in one of those booths one time and it's pretty freaking sweet, man. Like it feels like a level of professionality, but yeah.
It's like many thousands of dollars. There's two, you know, we're gonna have to amortize this thing over a number of years to make it worth it. But Kraft chipped in on it and we're all going to use it. They're going to do their podcast in here. And, you know, we're trying to make it worth it, make ourselves. Yeah, sometimes you got to buy yourself the, you know, dress for the job or whatever.
Just buy the podcast studio you want to be the podcast. So that's good. That's good.
I'm going to get a little frame picture of Ira Glass in here. You know,
maybe that's good. Yeah. Other NPR celebrity Terry Gross. Yeah. Just you could name it the Terry Gross podcast booth.
I don't know how I got started on that, but I'm in the booth right now. It's great.
That's cool. Cool.
So, and it's when you listen to this, dear listener, our favorite people on earth, Shopomaniacs, it will be 2018. So congratulations for living through another year.
You made it. You're here. You got probably work. You got to-dos burning a hole in your pocket already. So
we're recording this just before, but I would like to, you know, it's a new year. Our loose notes for the show was, can we talk about front-end web development in 2018? This will probably have to sprinkle through a number of episodes, but can we take the opportunity? We're halfway through the show. Can we spend the rest of the second half talking about what's going to happen in 2018?
What's web dev in 2018? Chris, you got any hot tips? You got any insights?
I just feel like there's some obvious ones. And in fact, I should have like 10 tabs open to other people's predictions. I feel like I've read a few, and there's two types of articles. They're like what happened in 2017 and like what's going to happen in 2018. I've read more 2017s than 18 articles, I think.
Sure. A lot of it is AI and machine learning.
Oh my God. You know, you convince me occasionally to be interested in these things, but I you know, I mostly want them to just help me behind the scenes. I don't have a ton of interest in like, I don't know, writing the code myself. I don't know what to say about that, because I want to benefit from it. I just can't get excited about actually learning it.
I agree with that. I want AI that makes my, like, that makes my productivity soar, not that takes my job. Does that make sense? Like, I don't know. How do I get that AI? But I think it's mostly right. Like,
well, here, I have a database full. I mean, think of the amount of data that CodePen has that we take very seriously and securely and all that, you know, like, but there's interesting, and we already do some interesting stuff here. Like, give us a score. Like, we have this one thing that is part of the app that only admins can see, that give us a score for every particular pen of how likely it is that it's a copy of something else. And so if that as that number approaches one, that we're like, before I like pick or feature this pen, I want to check out like the lineage around this thing and make sure that it isn't like a stolen pen or whatever. Although that might be too heavy of language, because sometimes people just copy code and they don't really know what they're doing, and it's all open source anyway, which is completely fine. I just don't want to like feature the wrong author of a pen. So, and that stuff is in the wheelhouse of machine learning.
You don't want to credit Sarah Drasner, because she always steals it from David Piano.
That's right. She's
just a big old thief. No,
not at all. Sarah's the best.
She's the best.
That stuff is in that wheelhouse, right? So I can't sit here and be like, I don't care about that stuff, because I clearly do. It benefits as a company. What if I could give my database to some secure machine in the sky and they'd say, you know what? I got some insight for you. This is how you're going to fix all your churn problems. I can see all these pro users, when they signed up, when they left. Here's some incredible insight to make your business healthier. You know, here's 10 tips that I have figured out just by looking at your database full of data. You better believe I want that.
Yeah, no, I mean, why, you know, you want, like, you, if you can, anything you can get insight from, you know, or like yeah. Oh, hey, I'm a robot, beep, bleep, blorp. I went through your database and I noticed 10 people quit. You know, they're members for 5 years. And
sure.
These are high value people. Here's an alert.
Somebody made this pen just now 10 minutes ago, and it's algorithmically looks like a pen that would be, because I can tell all the picked pens through time, of which there's tens, if not hundreds of thousands of, versus their millions of pen. I can machine understand AI that pen that was created 5 seconds ago has the right kind of traits that it's probably pick worthy. So here's a list of pick-worthy pens that you maybe weren't otherwise aware of. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. That mm-hmm. seems fantastical. And like, how can that possibly work? But it totally can.
Yeah. Anyway. And then there's also maybe, and not to scud this whole thing, but that like there's, you know, maybe it's like, you know, if you do the algorithm wrong, it just, you know, keeps picking the same 6 people over and over and over. It's Anna Tudor, you know, yeah. It's just like the same 6 people, because it, like, they consistently build like cool stuff. And then it's like Anna Tudor knockoffs or whatever. And it's like, you don't, you know, like what, I guess, how do
weapons
you prevent
of
the
mass
machine
destruction?
Yeah. How do you prevent like people from or how do you prevent the machine from being just reinforcing?
It might have something to do with how much control you give it. You know, like if you just like let the algorithm go, you know, and that weapons of math destruction, I think we've discussed on the show before a little bit, is literally a book that goes into some of this stuff. You know, some of the problems is if you give an algorithm too much power, like we're going to fire a teacher because algorithmically they perform poorly, and we're not going to have any kind of human intervention at that all. The algorithm scored you low, you're fired. Whereas maybe a healthier way is the algorithm scored you low. That's giving us some insight into how we can run our business a little bit. Now it's time for humans to look at that data output and make human decisions based around it. So if it just gave us some, you know, some likelihoods and some interesting math to look at, but we still press the button to feature a pen or not, that gives us this opportunity to reflect on the data that it's giving us. And possibly if it's giving us bad data that we can tell because we're humans, then we can fine-tune it. And that was another thing that was pointed out heavily in that book, is that a dangerous algorithm is one that never changes. Good algorithms are ones that you can evaluate and see if it's making a mistake and change.
Nice, yeah. Like a learning, self-correcting. Yeah.
Sure. Isn't that the definition of AI, kind of?
I guess, yeah, a machine that learns. But I guess, you know, it's like if it only learns to do one way, you know, like, I think I worry about, you know, everyone talks about like, you know, machines learning how to do web design. And I actually, like, not to be a spookster again. Oh, gosh, my tinfoil hat is so heavy. But I do wonder, like, I do think it's like kind of around the corner or something, like a machine will be able to build a rudimentary website or marketing page.
With what? So, what do you give it?
I don't know. Maybe like you just type some adjectives into a thing and it just says, okay, I'll do my best. Like, and comes, you know, and just, and that's the thing with AI. It doesn't have to be great. It just has to do it as good as like 50% of humans or something. Does that make sense? Like,
I wonder,
like,
if Google is interesting to do it because they know, because so many businesses already are incentivized to make sure that, you know, that you provide business information to them. Like, what are your hours? Where are you located? What are your holiday hours? What are, you know, a smart business will do that already. And then it's like, well, they have mapping data. They have pictures of your front door. So, you know, I feel like they can make a pretty wonderful website for you with the click of a button kind of thing. Here's what your business looks like. Here's where it is. Here's when it's open, and website produced.
Yeah, no, I mean, it could maybe kind of figure that out. And, you know, but that's all that to say is I think it can only really, like, the way in my brain, I don't know if that, like, a robot can, like, invent a new web design trend or, like, come up with something really cool and interesting. It can only reproduce what it knows is good. And that's kind of, like, tried and true layouts and patterns, you know? It doesn't, like, how, you know, I guess, like, robots aren't going to break the rules, you know, and I think that's kind of where some of the magic happens, you know, in web design. So anyway, that's kind of what's interesting to me. So I think, like,
it's funny because I think of, does, like, that make sense? You know, we're already like, oh, are we going to lose our jobs? Well, we've already experienced this revolution once in a way, in that there's already been this, a certain tier of website that used to require the hiring of some kind of web designer master something to help you build it, because you're building a website for Jill's Bakery down the street. That market has already been decimated. I don't know. You could argue with me if you want, but it seems like that's where it points, is that those things are handled by the Wix and Weebly and Squarespace, et cetera, of the world, and handled quite well. So all of a sudden there's that low tier of design market that used to be freelance that's already gone. And so what happens then? Is it, does this machine learning stuff start gobbling up higher and higher markets, like the $10,000 website? Does it start eating up that? Or is it start at the bottom again? And I think it's more likely to start at the bottom again and start in some kind of automated design website building is going to eat away at that market before it eats away at higher markets.
Yeah, that's probably true, right? It's probably going to bottom feed. it's going to cannibalize the easiest path, right?
Right. If you're worried, yeah. You know, Squarespace should be worried, not.
That's probably true. Wow. That's kind of pretty interesting. Interesting to think about.
I'm a genius and I have excellent insight into anything.
You're a fraught leader.
That's very good. This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Daddy, that's D-A-D-I, .cloud. It's a global decentralized cloud services platform, like in the vein of AWS or Google Cloud Platform or Microsoft Azure or whatever, but not them. That would be a centralized platform. This is a decentralized platform, bringing control of the internet back to the people. You even pay for it with a cryptocurrency based on blockchain, like Bitcoin, or more accurately, in this case, Ethereum. There's a crowd sale coming up for the initial offering of this, these Daddy tokens, literally what you use to pay for these cloud services. It's coming up. It's the fastest growing crowd sale on Telegram, which is pretty darn cool. You can register for the crowd sale at daddy.cloud, of course. Again, it's decentralized hosting for web services, brings control of the internet back to the people, works in support of net neutrality. The technology is already there. It already exists. It's already powering over 200 websites. And probably most significantly, it's up to 90% cheaper than other centralized platforms like AWS and Google Cloud Platform and all that stuff. So it's a lot cheaper and it's a lot decentralized. So if you're picking infrastructure for a new thing, this feels a lot like the future. It's faster because of the, you know, the distributed nature of the network, which is pretty darn cool. Over 25,000 people are already registered to be investors as part of this public sale. Check it all out at daddy.cloud. All right. I think people listening to this show are probably more interested in like, okay, but what's up? Like ignoring all that fancy stuff. What are actual browser stuff? What's, you know, the easy answer. Yeah. Yeah. You go.
Oh, you're going to say grid. Grid?
I mean, yeah. Grid's a big deal, and it's people are learning it right and left. Everybody and their brother is making a course about CSS Grid. People are starting to understand it. They're starting to see the potential. There's not that many people being like, I don't get this syntax. It's too weird. People are like, yeah, it's a little foreign to me. And then they look into it and they're like, oh, I'm going to write a blog post about it. You know, like it has the right.
Yeah.
It's taken over and it's taken over in a very fast way because so many browsers support it. So even the conversations about browser support are getting harder and harder to find. People care less and less about that, which, you know, whatever you want to think about that. But so, okay. We have wonderful web layout. That's obviously going to continue to be a very big deal in 2018. We're going to see that be used in big ways.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we're just kind of breaking ground on cool layouts. So I think it should be, I think we'll have a lot to kind of see and experiment and talk about. I mean, I'm looking, you mentioned sound panels. So I went on Amazon and started looking for sound panels, but I'm looking at Amazon right now. And it's just a bunch of grid of boxes and, you know, book covers and squares and rectangles. And, you know, it's a grid. Everything's a grid. Like this is,
imagine the implications of this. Now, if you're coming up and just learning web design, and this is what you're seeing being taught, and this is the one true way of web layout that you're learning. And if life happens fast, man, you take some course at a thing and now you're a web developer and Amazon snatches you up. And now you're the person designing Amazon pages. And the grid is the tool you have and the tool that's approved to use, you're going to use it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Amazon probably has a bigger support matrix than just grid browsers.
Probably, but the years trickle by pretty quick.
Oh, man. I mean, and they would probably, anything they're going to roll out is probably like grid safe. I mean, just they're probably, you don't just ship things the day of, I'm sure, at Amazon. It takes a little while to get out. So I think like you're probably, anyway, it's just everything's going to be better with this. I feel like jealous of people who get to start now.
Here's another implication of it. I think both browsers and standards people are proud of this story, and that momentum is going to roll on. They're going to be like, look at what we can do if we work together and work hard on this thing. And it's not like it happened overnight, but it happened really well. So, like, let's do it again.
I want to give a high five, shout out, shop talk clap to everyone who like worked on Grid, just because it's a good API. And like you said, it's very rudimentary, and you're almost like, what is this noise? And then you use it and you're like, oh, I get it. Oh, it's got some tricks. Oh, cool. Like it's the building blocks for the thing you want, you know? And so I just really well done to everybody. I think obviously Rachel Andrew kind of QA'd a lot of the stuff. I know Eric Meyer did some stuff too. So thanks everybody and Jen Simmons, of course, but
well done. Yes. And those are the evangelists and feedbackers but are now involved directly with browser stuff. So their stories have changed as well. But there's a lot of behind the scenes stuff and spec writers and stuff. There's a lot of people deserve claps here, which is fascinating. So that's Grid. That's almost an obvious choice in a way. I have one that's maybe equally or more obvious to a certain class of people and less obvious to others. And I think the class that it's less obvious to is front-end web developers. So it's kind of perfect for the show.
Oh, hit it. All right.
And I think it's serverless, whatever that word means. And I know that's changing and evolving and stuff. But this idea that what we think of as web hosting is changing a lot, and it's going to change a lot this year, you know, and that the way we think about, like, where do we, like, put the work that we produce, and how do we think about, like, how we interact and pay for and configure and ask of our servers is totally changing.
I think that's
going to have implications to front-end web development. I think back-end people are already, like, ahead of the game here. They're already like, oh, man, I can spin up a Lambda thing, and we're going to save a bunch of money, and it just makes sense as a little API kind of thing. They're ahead of the curve and asking of that. But now we're like, giving those same tools to front-end developers, being like, oh, wow, I don't really need any help on this. I can do what I need to do using the skills I already have as a front-end developer to do interesting things. And so, you know, you say what you think first.
No, I think just even what you said, like the way we interact with servers is going to change. I think you're right. Like, you know, if you figure out how to do your backend with like a Lambda function, which is basically like, I guess we should describe that, but sort of like say like, hey, add a favorite or something. Would that be a good example? Like user clicks a button.
But that means you're going to need some data there. I mean, that's automatically complicates it a little bit, because that means you have data storage that you need to put somewhere, like, also.
Process an image or something.
Sure. Process
an avatar. Like, you kind of don't want to do that on your main system because you'll bog down your thing, but you're basically like, okay, I'll hand this off to a computer, another computer in the cloud, and they'll kind of churn it and then hand it back to me and save it somewhere. Is that better?
That's a good one, because it's something that really is too hard sometimes for the client to do. Or even if it's not that hard, sometimes it makes sense just architecturally to have a URL endpoint. I think of it as URLs. You know, give me a URL where I can send something to and it'll send me something back. It could be just serve up some data, serve up a web page, do some processing on something, whatever.
It's basically like a Slack bot that you can hit, you know, with some data, and it'll give you something back. And I think that's really cool. I think that's actually going to affect the front end. If you listen to the HTTP 203 podcast, which is impossible to Google, but it's who Jake Archibald and Das Surma, they did like a 18 thing or 12 things that'll be cool about web development in 2018 or something, or like an Advent kind of thing, 12 days of Christmas thing. But they've been talking about web workers, which are kind of the same thing. It's basically a serverless thread in the browser on the client. So like now,
but it doesn't just like bug. It doesn't like bog down your website. Cause it's like
it's off the main UI thread. So like you can basically like decode an image or whatever in a worker, and then hand it back to the browser. And it's going to be async, which is kind of another big word.
It doesn't slow you down, but it is fast, because imagine, you know, one of the slowest things always with web performance is the internet itself is sending a request out and all the latency and slowness of that and coming back. And that stuff can be made fast, but it'll never be as fast as something happening that doesn't even have to leave your computer.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, it's basically you're just saying like, hey, start a new application, a new tab, and run this thing and come back to me and then close that tab when you're done. And that's going to be really cool. And so I think there's like going to be a lot of parallels between the server and the serverless and the client and the worker, and service workers included in that too. Like how, you know, I think we're just cracking what.
Right. But there's a big one too here, which is that data storage bit, which is, okay, now I have this ability to run, which are often called cloud functions, which is a great name for them. And you can include web workers in that too. But, you know, imagine that you're, you know, and they're often written in JavaScript. So you can just write them in Node. And so that you're kind of recycling your front end skills to do that too. And then a lot of the places that also run your cloud functions will store data for you as well. So think of Firebase. Firebase is great for storing data online, but there's other things that are competing with that now. Like, because I want to store some data. I want to store a favorite for something, like you just mentioned. Well, I need some kind of database to do that. And that may be a moment where a front-end developer is like, nope, my skills fall over. I need help now. It won't be that way anymore. Like if you just need to store some simple data, there's lots of ways to do that. So now I'm communicating with cloud functions. Those cloud functions might be communicating with the data, or directly from the client, I'm communicating with that data. Wow. And guess what store format that data is often in? JSON, which is totally digestible at the on the front end. So it's like, wow. And I think worlds are colliding here. If you'll allow me to get even more abstract with this, we're already used to things like GitHub Pages, say, like you, isn't your blog.
I use a lot.
Jekyll. That,
yeah, you know. I use a lot of GitHub Pages.
So, and you know what backend languages GitHub Pages runs? None. Not really. You know, you can do JavaScript there, but you can't run your Python app or your Rails app. None of that stuff. It's a static file host. Have you seen Netlify? They're a big hosting company. They got lots of money. People are loving them. They don't run any backend languages. It's a static file host. It's like a CDN for HTML files. It's crazy.
Beefed up Nginx. It's just serves HTML.
Right, but it does it super fast. And now they're competing with, like, here's ways that, like, if that's taken for granted, what about other cool developer conveniences can we give you? Like, staging environments are trivial to spin up and give you. And you can build in that way. And so let's start with this baseline of super fast. And go with that. What about CodePen? You know, I'll relate it to myself here. CodePen doesn't run any backend languages for you either, but you can build front end. So all these like big things that are just like static file hosts plus serverless is like, feels like a 2018 thing to me. And worlds colliding. So now I have Jekyll. I can throw that up on somewhere in my static file host, but also I can build really modern stuff. Because my JSON data is just in the cloud, the actual data for this thing, I can spin up a Vue single page app using Netlify or CodePen or whatever. I can, you know what I mean? Like it's old school, like static site generators meets new school, like Vue and React and all that stuff too. You can build both of those types of sites with this baseline.
No, I think I should probably look into it. I've been working on a little, just an experiment. It's like a Preact app that's like a Twitter client but it like does sentiment analysis and like tries to measure toxicity of your Twitter stream. So just so you kind of know what you're getting into before you like enter Twitter. And but I wrote this whole Express server for it that I run, you know, on the thing, nice. Client or whatever. But then
run Express like, as a cloud function as well, by the way.
Yeah. Well, why wouldn't, yeah. Why I could just, these are just functions that hit the Twitter API and come back, spit back data. I don't, you know, they're not the client is like a whole separate, like Preact server, you know, like it's a whole other app running. So I kind of don't even need like I just need a static HTML server. That could be anything. That could be MAMP if I wanted it to. Because I just want the
like the days HTML. Of spinning up going to be like, well, let's see, what does this host have? It's $19.99 a month for, and it's got PHP installed on it, and you know, I get 200 megabytes of storage. You know, like that kind of thing is still useful in a way. Like that'll spin up people's WordPress sites, and that's fine and stuff. But if we're talking about trends in the future and what we're going to see more of, that's going away in favor of just something that can return an HTML file.
Yeah, no, just something that hands off JSON. So I built this whole Express server, but now I'm just like, oh, maybe I could have split that up into some cloud functions. Like you said, cloud functions. And then I just hit those URLs and then bingo.
And we're
bingo.
Not just dreaming stuff up here. We're not like in a garage being like, I think this is where the industry is headed. I mean, it's already there in a way. I mean, AWS is competing in this market. Azure's Google Cloud Functions is Google Cloud Platform is like, yeah, Firebase is cool, but we have this whole platform that's like Big Brother, that's like, you know, a competition to AWS. Obviously, Azure's fighting in this world. The IBM's trying to get in on it with Cloud Function stuff. Everybody is like wants to be your infrastructure provider. In some ways, this Cloud Function stuff is just a loss leader for them in a way. It's like something to take advantage of right now because they want you to be like, oh, this is really cool. I can spin up a little cloud function on Azure. But if the rest of my infrastructure was here, that'd be cool too. So maybe we'll just make cloud functions really easy to write for people. And then that will encourage them to like move over their whole infrastructure.
Wow. Well, that's pretty cool to think about.
I'm sure I said a lot of stuff wrong too, so feel free to write me emails about this stuff. But I'm really interested in it, and I think front end plus serverless is a topic.
you almost need to tap into the hello world. And I'm sure there is something, and it's just like, here, create a cloud function that returns hello world. But like, what's the like 15-minute blog version? I go back to that Rails example, you know, is like, whoa, I can make a blog in 15 minutes. That's amazing. You know, like that, what is that demo, that POC? You almost need to discover that with serverless and kind of like write that out, or, you know, somebody needs to write that post and then kind of get people thinking and get people kind of working on it. So,
yeah, I think there's 10 to be written, and I'm sort of working on it.
good. Well, what else, Chris? What's, I guess we
get, I don't know. We should probably hit it. Yeah, we are. Maybe let's just morph this into next week while we get back into questions, but continue to talk about future tech.
2018 part two. Send us your ideas. All right. Well, thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star heart favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. And thank you again for joining us for 290 something episodes. This is really amazing. Really thankful. Thank y'all, and thank our sponsors as well for joining us along the road. And yeah, follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.